Tape recorded message number TL462. Otis Q. Sellers, Bible Teacher. I greet you in the faith and fellowship of our great God and Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, whose we are, whom we love, and whom we serve. Take your Bibles and turn with me to 1 Samuel chapter 5. Our study begins with the first verse of chapter 5 of 1 Samuel. In our last lesson, we saw that the Ark of God, Israel's most precious material possession, had been captured by the Philistines. And in due time, that which could mean a blessing to Israel if their hearts were right before God, it does become a very definite curse to the Philistines. And so they've captured the Ark of God. Now, in regard to this, there are some words said by Dr. Blakey, Dr. W.G. Blakey, in his exposition of 1 Samuel that's both helpful and informative, and I could take this material and turn it into my own words, but I would just as soon read it from his words. He makes a statement that although the history in Samuel is silent as the doings of the Philistines immediately after their great victory over Israel, yet we learn from other parts of the Bible, such as Psalm 78, verses 60-64, Jeremiah 7:12, and 26:9, that they proceeded to Shiloh. The Philistines proceeded to Shiloh, that they massacred the priest, that they wrecked the city, and left it a monument of desolation, as it continued to be ever after that. Now, probably this was considered an appropriate sequel to the capture of the Ark, a fitting mode of completing and commemorating their victory over the national God of the Hebrews. For we may well believe that it was this unprecedented feature of their success that was uppermost in the Philistines' minds. The prevalent idea among the surrounding nations regarding the God of the Hebrews was that he was a God of exceeding power. That was the prevailing thought. The wonders done by him in Egypt still fill the popular imagination. You could read about that when we get in chapter 6 and verse 6, where it says, "Wherefore then do ye harden your hearts, as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts, when he wrought wonderfully among them, and they did not let the people go, and they departed." These are the Philistines talking, and they're talking about the wonders that God worked in Egypt. They speak of the strong hand and the outstretched arm with which he had driven out the seven nations of Canaan and prepared the way for his people. These things were not forgotten. Neither in more recent conflicts had any of the surrounding nations obtained the slightest advantage over them. It was in his name, that is, the name of Jehovah, that Barak and Deborah had defeated the Canaanites. It was the sword of the Lord of Gideon that had thrown such consternation into the heart of the Midianites. But now the tide was completely turned. Not only had the Hebrew God failed to protect his people, but ruin had come on both him and them, the way the Philistines looked at it, and his very sanctuary in Shiloh was in Philistine hands. Now, there's no wonder that the Philistines were marvelously elated. They seemed to say, "Let us sweep from the face of the earth every trace and memorial of his worship." That was their cry. "Let us inflict such humiliation on the spot sacred to his name, that never again shall his worshippers be able to regain their courage and lift up their heads and neither we nor our children shall tremble any more at the mention of his terrible deeds. That is Jehovah's terrible deeds. Now, we don't find one word about Samuel in connection with all of this. The news from the battlefield, followed by the death of Eli and of the wife of Phinehas, must have been a terrible blow to him. But besides being calm of nature, as his bearing showed after he got the message about Eli's house, Samuel was habitually in fellowship with God, and in this habit enjoyed a great help toward self-possession and promptitude of action in sudden emergencies and perplexities. A good thing to always remember that when men do live close to God, and then they suddenly come upon something that is difficult, it just comes upon them all at once. They do not need to work to open up avenues of communication and to get their lives in such shape that they feel that they can approach God in regard to these things. For those who live habitually close to God, those who live in habitual fellowship with Him, well, they have this great reserve that they can always call into action when they come into sudden emergencies and great perplexities. And now, that the ill-advised scheme for carrying the ark into battle implied any real humiliation to God of Israel, or that it would have any evil effect on the covenant sworn to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Samuel could not for a moment suppose. But the confusion and trouble that would arise, especially if the Philistines advanced upon Shiloh, was a very serious consideration. There was much left at Shiloh that needed to be cared for. There were sacred vessels there. These were sacred vessels that God had told them to prepare, and they had prepared them. And there were also the national records. If so, because this was where they were kept. And these things must not be allowed to fall in the hands of the enemy. Now, we do not know by what means Samuel was able to secure the safety of these. I would very much like to know. You would very much like to know, and we would like to know how he secured his personal safety when the priests fell by the sword. As we are told in Psalm 78, verse 64, we do not know. But we do know this, that the Samuel who had lived close to the Lord, and the Lord who had been close to him, he was with Samuel even in this hour of national horror. God directed his proceedings, and he established upon him the work of his hands. Now this fact to which we have drawn attention, that it was over the God of Israel that the Philistines had triumphed, that's the key to all the transactions recorded so minutely in the 5th and 6th chapters. The great object of these two chapters that we're going to review now is to show how God undeceived the Philistines, straightened them out on this all-important point. He undeceived them, that is, he straightened them out in a very quiet, undemonstrative manner. On certain occasions, God impresses men by his great agencies. You know, we know that God's impressed men by fire and earthquake and tempest, the very stormy wind fulfilling his word. But these are not needed on this occasion. Agencies, much less striking, will do the work. God will recover his name and fame among the nations by much humbler forces. By the most trembling exertion, pardon me, the most trifling exertion of his power, these Philistines will be brought to their wits' ends, and all the wisdom of the wisest men and all the craft of their most cunning priest will be needed to devise some propitiation for the one who is infinitely too strong for them, and to prevent their country from being brought to ruin by the silent working of his resistless power. Well, let's see how he does it. We read here that the Philistines took the Ark of God. This is verse 1 of the 5th chapter. That they took the Ark of God, and they brought it from Ebenezer, where the battle had been fought and the victory had been won. They have brought it from Ebenezer unto Ashdod. Now, when the Philistines took the Ark of God, they brought it into the house of Dagon. That was their god, their national god, and they set it by Dagon. And when they of Ashdod arose early in the morning, behold, Dagon was fallen upon his face to the earth before the ark of the Lord. What a strange thing. Seems almost a trifling thing. But there it was, the statue of their great god Dagon has fallen upon his face, and it's right there before the ark of the Lord. Well, they took Dagon, they patched him up and set him in his place again. Strange indeed when men have to take God, their God, and set him in their place, in his place. So in verse 4, when they arose early on the next morning, behold, Dagon was fallen upon his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. And the head of Dagon and both of the palms of his hands were cut off upon the threshold. Just the stump of Dagon was left to him. Therefore, neither the priest of Dagon, nor any that came into Dagon's house, tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod unto this day, right up the time that this was written. They just never have dared to go into this house. But the hand of the Lord was heavy upon them of Ashdod, and he destroyed them and smote them with emerods, even Ashdod and the coast thereof. Now, this that is called emerods here, we do not exactly know what this was. But those who have studied the case and sought to find out what this was, they say that they were smitten with some form of dysenteric or typhoid disease in which a loathsome rectal protrusion was a prominent system. That was one of the systems of it, a loathsome rectal protrusion, as if, shall we say, that their very intestinal tract was coming out of the anus of these men. And so this was this disease. Now we have something that is called hemorrhoids today, which might be a rectal protrusion, but nevertheless, this is not the same as this that they suffered with. Now, they were smitten here now with the emerods, and the hand of the Lord was upon them. Even Ashdod and all the coast, that would be the borders thereof. And the 7th verse, when the men of Ashdod saw that it was so, they said, the ark of God of Israel shall not abide with us, for his hand is sore upon us and upon Dagon our God. They sent therefore and gathered all the lords of the Philistines unto them and said, what shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel? And they said, let the ark of the God of Israel be carried unto Gath. And they carried the ark of God of Israel about thither. And it was so that after they had carried it about, the hand of the Lord was against the city with a very great destruction. He smote the men of the city, both small and great, and they had emerods in their secret parts. Therefore they sent the ark of God to Ekron. It came to pass, as the ark of God came to Ekron, that the Ekronites cried out, saying, we don't want this, we will not have it. They've brought the ark of the God of Israel to us to slay us and our people. So they sent and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines, and said, send away the ark of the God of Israel. Let it go again to its own place, that it slay us not and our people. For there is a deadly destruction throughout all the city. The hand of God was very heavy there. And the men that died not were smitten with the emerods, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. This was the cry of it. It went up to heaven. Heaven here being a name, really, for God, that it just went up to God. Now, in chapter 6, the Ark of the Lord was in the country of the Philistines 7 months. And it's a trouble to them. Now, they've cried out. Well, the Philistines call for the priests and the diviners, saying, "What shall we do with the Ark of the Lord? Tell us wherewith we shall send it to his place." And they said, "If ye send away the Ark of the God of Israel, send it not empty, but in any wise return him a trespass offering. Then you shall be healed, and it shall be known to you why his hand is not removed from you." This is a known custom, known from archaeology, that this was a custom among people that when they felt that they had been delivered, like when they were delivered in the hands of the enemy, to offer unto God pictures of the battle. They would draw, paint these pictures of their success in the battle and present these before the Lord. So these priests said, send an offering. In the fourth verse, then said they, "What shall be the trespass offering which we shall return to him?" Their priest answered and said, 5 golden emeralds, emeralds that were made of gold in the shape of this protrusion, 5 golden mice, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines, for one plague was upon you all and on your lords. Wherefore ye shall make images of your emeralds, images of your mice that mar the land. And from this we would judge that there was an invasion of mice into the standing grain, and these mice can do an enormous amount of damage, as anyone knows who's ever had to put up with such a plague. And ye shall give glory to the God of Israel. In other words, you'll give recognition unto the God of Israel. One meaning of our English word glory is recognition. And you see the force that it has here when we get this. It was not just them giving what we commonly think of as glory, but them giving recognition to the God of Israel. And peradventure he will lighten his hand from off for you, and from your gods, and from off your land. Wherefore then do ye harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts. These Philistines know all about this, even though it is many, many years later. They know all about this. It's carried in their traditions. When he had wrought wonderfully among them, and they did not let the people go, and they departed. Now therefore make a new cart. They're going to be very religious about this, so they'll make a new cart. And take 2 milk kine, 2 milk cows, on which there hath come no yoke. For they use their milk cows even to draw the yoke. And tie the kine, these cows, to the cart, and bring their calves home from them. And take the Ark of the Lord, and lay it upon the cart, and put the jewels of gold, which you return unto them for a trespass offering, in a coffer by the side thereof, and send it away, so that it may be so. Then see if it goeth up by the way of his own coast to Beth Shemesh. Then he hath done us this great evil. But if not, then we shall know that it is not his hand that smote us. It was just a chance that happened to us. So the men did so. And they took 2 milk cows. They tied them to the cart. And they shut up their calves at home. And all of us who have had any experience with cows and their calves know exactly what would take place if this were done. But it didn't take place that way. In verse 11, they laid the Ark of the Lord upon the cart, and the coffer with the mice of gold, and the images of their emeralds. And the king took, and the kine, pardon me, these milk cows, they took the straight way to the way of Beth Shemesh. And as they went along the highway, lowing as they went, they're lowing because they're separated in their calves. And yet they can do nothing at all but take the road that the Lord lays out for them. These are the cattle. The cows would want to return to their calves. I'm sure the calves were bawling for the cows, their mothers, to give them milk. They're separated from them. And yet the cows go right along, And they take the straight way of Beth Shemesh. They went along the highway. They're lowing as they went. This isn't a secret. But they turned not aside to the right hand or the left. And the lords of the Philistines are following after them. And they're following right after till they get to the very border of Beth Shemesh. And they of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley. They lifted up their eyes, they looked up, as we would say. They saw the ark, and they rejoiced to see it. And the cart came into the field of Joshua, a Bethshemite, and stood there where there was a great stone. So they took the wood of the cart, split it up, and they offered the cattle as a burnt offering unto the Lord. They didn't keep it as some religious trophy to be kissed and worshipped forever after. They took this and the very heathen contraption that these men had taken up to get the Lord back, these men destroyed it right there, both the cattle and the ark itself. And the Levites took down the ark of the Lord and the coffer wherein wherein the jewels of gold were. And they put them on the great stone. And the men of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and sacrificed sacrifices the same day unto the Lord. And when the five lords of the Philistines had seen it, they returned to Ekron the same day. And then it says, these are the golden emerods which the Philistines returned for a trespass offering unto the Lord. For Ashdod one, for Gaza one, for Ashkelon one, for Gath one, for Ekron one. The golden mice, according to the number of all the cities of the Philistines, belonging to the five lords, both of fenced cities and of country villages, even unto the great stones of Abel, whereon they set down the ark of the Lord, which stone remaineth this day in the field of Joshua the Bethshemite. And he smote the men of Beth Shemesh, because they had looked into the ark of the Lord. They had no right to do that, because they had looked in it. Even he smote the people, and he says here now, 50,000 and 70 men. Now, the text here, the Hebrew text reads, he smote them, 70 men, 250s, and 1,000. And if you'd add that up, the men smitten would be 1,170. And the people lamented because the Lord had smitten many of the people with a great slaughter. And the men of Beth Shemesh said, who is able to stand before the holy Lord God? And to whom shall he go up from us? And they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kirjath-Jearim, saying, the Philistines have brought again the ark of the Lord. Come ye down and fetch it up to you. And the men of Kirjath-Jearim came, fetched up the ark of the Lord. They brought it to the house of Abinadab in the hill, and they sanctified Eleazar and his son to keep the ark of the Lord. To sanctify is just simply to set apart for holy service, and this is an excellent illustration of what this means. And these men were set apart for hallowed service. The word just would mean set apart. It doesn't have anything to do with their sins or their characters. But they sanctified Eleazar and his son to keep the ark of the Lord, to guard it. And it came to pass, while the ark abode in Kirjath-Jearim, that the time was long, for it was 20 years, and all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. Now, the third verse, Samuel spake unto all the house of Israel, saying, if you do return unto the Lord with all your hearts, then put away the strange gods and Ashtaroth from among you, and prepare your hearts unto the Lord, and serve him only. He will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. And the children of Israel did put away Balaam and Ashtaroth, and they served the Lord only. And Samuel said, gather all Israel to Mizpah, and I will pray for you unto the Lord. And they gathered together to Mizpah, and they drew water, and they poured it out before the Lord. Here the pouring out of water was a symbol. There are many times that the use of water became symbolic in Israel. They had certain baptisms that they practiced. The word baptism and the practice of baptism was not a new thing with John the Baptist. It was just simply a divine baptism that God gave to him to perform. He was the only man that was ever called the Baptist. Nobody else was given that name. And he did use water, a water ceremony, to make the Messiah manifest to Israel and to identify individual men with the submissive ones. So they fasted on that day, and they said there, "We have sinned against the Lord." This is a confession. We have sinned against the Lord. And Samuel judged the children of Israel in Mizpah. And when the Philistines heard that the children of Israel gathered together in Mizpah, the lords of the Philistines went up against Israel. When the children of Israel heard it, they were afraid of the Philistines. And the children of Israel said to Samuel, "Cease not to crown the Lord our God for us, that he will save us out of the hand of the Philistines." Now Samuel took a sucking lamb. You see, Samuel was a Levite. He could do this, had every right to perform this priestly work, for he was a Levite. Samuel took a sucking lamb and offered it for a burnt offering holy unto the Lord. And Samuel cried unto the Lord for Israel, and the Lord heard him. And as Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to battle against Israel. But the Lord thundered with a great thunder on that day upon the Philistines and discomfited them. And they were smitten before Israel. And the men of Israel went out of Mizpah and pursued the Philistines and smote them, and they came unto Bethcar. Then Samuel took a stone and set it between Mizpah and Shen, and called the name of it Ebenezer, saying, "Hitherto hath the Lord helped us." Ebenezer means the stone of help, but what he said was, "Hitherto hath the Lord helped us." So the Philistines were subdued. They came no more into the whole coast of Israel, the borders of Israel. And the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. And the cities which the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel, from Ekron even unto Gath. And the coast thereof did Israel deliver out of the hand of the Philistines. And there was peace between Israel and the Amorites. And Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life. And he went from year to year in circuit to Bethel and Gilgal and Mizpah, and he judged Israel in all those places. And his return was to Ramah, for there was his house. And there he judged Israel, and there he built an altar unto the Lord. Well, it came to pass, when Israel was old, that he made his sons judges over Israel. We can doubt the wisdom of this, and the outcome would show that it was a mistake. But he was old, and he made his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of the firstborn was Joel. The name of the second, Abiah. They were judges in Bathsheba. But his sons walked not in his ways. They'd have been good men if they'd walked in his ways. They turned aside after lucre, which is money gotten by evil means. Ill-gotten gains, we call them. They took bribes. They could be paid off, and they perverted judgment. And all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together, and they came to Samuel unto Ramah. They said unto him, "Behold, you are old, and your sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like other nations." But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord. Now the Lord said unto Samuel, "Hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say to thee. For they have not rejected thee, they've rejected me, that I should not reign over them." You see, at this time, the government in Israel was by a theocracy. God showing Samuel what to do, telling him what to do, and Samuel doing it. We doubt if Samuel waited upon the Lord about appointing his men to be judges, therefore he more or less acted upon his own. But as a rule, he acted upon the word of the Lord. And so when they rejected Samuel, they were rejecting God. They have not rejected thee, they've rejected me, that I should not reign over them. Now to reign is to govern, and that's what God had been doing. God had been governing. He had allowed men to walk in their own ways. He had allowed nations to walk in their own ways. But it could be expected that the great king would always intervene, would always act, and he did. So he said that I shall not reign over them according to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to unto this day wherewith they have forsaken me and served other gods, so do they also unto thee. In other words, Samuel, what you're getting is just the treatment that they've always given me. Now therefore hearken unto their voice. Howbeit, yet protest solemnly unto them, and show them the matter of the king that shall reign over them. Some of the mysterious workings of God. I'll give them the very kind of a king that they want, the kind of a man that they desire. I'll give them a man that'll look like what they think a king shall look like, and so on, and we'll see what comes of it. We'll see. And so this is the mysterious workings of God here in giving the people what they want and yet sending leanness to their souls. So he says, you show them solemnly the manner of king that shall reign over them. To reign is to govern. And Samuel told all the words of the Lord unto the people that asked for a king. And he said, now this will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons, and he'll appoint them for himself to be the drivers of his chariot, and to be his horsemen. And some shall run before his chariots. And he will appoint them captains over thousands, and captains over fifties. And he will set them to ear his ground, that is, to plant the soil, and to reap his harvest. And he'll put them to manufacture his instruments of war, instruments of his chariots. And he will take your daughters to be confectionaries, to be cooks and to be bakers. He will take your fields and your vineyards and your olive yards, even the best of them. He'll give them to his servants. And he will take the tenth of your seed, a tenth is a tithe, and of your vineyards, and he'll give it to his officers and to his servants. And he will take your men servants and your maid servants, your goodliest young man and your asses, and he'll put them to his work. He will take the tenth of your sheep, and ye shall be his servants. And ye shall cry out in that day because of your king, which he shall have chosen you, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. Get it straight, you'll cry out, but the Lord, Jehovah, will not hear you in that day. Now he told them all of this, but the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. They said, we can control him, we can handle him. We will not have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battle. And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he rehearsed them in the ears of the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, hearken unto their voice, and make them a king. So Samuel said unto the men of Israel, go ye every man into his city. Now there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish. He was the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechorath, the son of Aphiah, a Benjamite. He was a mighty man of power. Mighty man of power. He had a son whose name was Saul. He was a choice young man, and he was goodly. And there was not among the children of Israel a goodlier person than he. From his shoulders and upward, he was mightier than any of the people. And in 1 Samuel 10:23, there is a note here, a passage here that might help us to understand, where it says here that they ran and fetched him thence, and he, when he stood among the people, he was higher than any of the people from his shoulders upward. The tallest man in Israel, at the top of his head would have come just to the shoulder of Saul. And from his shoulders, this doesn't mean now just the ledge here, but the very shoulder itself, the top part of his body. In other words, we might really say that the tallest man in Israel would just come up to his armpit. He could have raised his arm, and the tallest man in Israel could have stood under his armpit. So that's how tall this man was. And so he was mightier than any of the people. And the asses of Kish, Saul's father, were lost. And these lost beasts of burden, the donkey, they start quite a story. And Kish said to Saul, his son, take now one of the servants with thee, and arise, and go seek the asses. So he passed through Mount Ephraim. He passed through the land of Shalisha. He find them not. Then they passed through the land of Shalem, and there they were not. Passed through the land of the Benjamites, but they found them not. When they were come to the land of Zeph, Saul said to his servant that was with him, come and let us return, lest my father leave caring, that is, being anxious for the asses, and takes thought for us, that is, becomes anxious for us. And he said unto him, behold, now there is in this city a man of God. He's an honorable man. A man of God is a prophet. He's an honorable man. All that he saith cometh surely to pass. Now let us go thither. Peradventure he can show us our way that we should go. Then said Saul to his servant, but behold, if we go, what shall we bring the man? For the bread is spent in our vessels. There is not a present to bring to the man of God, so what have we? And the servant answered Saul again and said, behold, I have here at hand, I've got the fourth part of a shekel of silver. That will I give to the man of God to tell us our way. Before time in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, thus he spake, come and let us go to the seer, for that he that is now called the prophet was before time called a seer. So, originally, a seer was a prophet, but he was called a seer. This time, he was called a prophet. Then said Saul to his servant, well said, come, let us go. So they went to the city where the man of God was. And as they went up the hill, the city, they found young maidens going out to draw water. And they said unto them, is the seer here? And they answered them and said, he is. Behold, he is before you. Make haste now, for he came today to the city. For there is a sacrifice of the people today in the high place. And as soon as ye be come into the city, ye shall straightway find him, before he go up to the high place to eat. For the people will not eat until he come, because he does bless the sacrifice. And afterwards they eat that be bidden. Now therefore get you up, for about this time ye shall find him. And they went up into the city. And when they were come into the city, behold, Samuel came out opposite them, against them would be opposite them, for to go up to the high place. And now the Lord had told Samuel in his ear a day before Saul came, saying, tomorrow about this time I will send a man out of the land of Benjamin, and thou shalt anoint him to be captain over my people Israel, that he save my people out of the hand of the Philistines, For I have looked upon my people, because their cry is come unto me. And when Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said unto him, Behold the man of whom I spake to thee of. This same shall reign over my people. He'll govern my people. Then Saul drew near to Samuel in the gate, and said, Tell me, I pray thee, where the seer's house is. And Samuel answered Saul, and said, I am the seer. Go up before me into the high place, for ye shall eat with me today, and tomorrow I will let you go, and I will tell thee all that is in thine heart. And as for thine asses that were lost 3 days ago, set not thy mind on them, for they are found. And on whom is all the desire of Israel? Is it not on thee and all thy father's house? You know, the desire of Israel was for a king. And here was the man who was to be their king. And Saul answered and said, Am I not a Benjamite, the smallest of the tribes of Israel? My family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin. Wherefore then speakest thou thus to me? Samuel took Saul and his servant, and brought them into the parlor, made them sit in the chiefest place among them that were bidden, which were about 30 persons. Samuel said unto the cook, Bring the portion which I gave thee, which I said unto thee, set it by thee. And the cook took up the shoulder, and that which was upon it, and set it before Saul. And Samuel said, Behold, that which is left, set it before thee and eat. For unto this time hath it been kept for thee, since I said, I have invited the people. So Saul did eat with Samuel that day. When they were come down the high place in the city, Samuel communed with Saul upon the top of the house. And they arose early. And it came to pass about the spring of the day that Samuel called Saul to the top of the house, saying, Up, that I may send thee away. And Saul arose, and they both went out, both of them, he and Samuel abroad. And as they were going down the end of the city, Samuel said to Saul, Bid the servant pass on before us. And he passed on. But you stand still a while, that I may show you the word of God. Well, my time is up. It's been a pleasure to go over this with you. I trust you've become more familiar with it. I know that I have. May the Lord bless it to your hearts and minds. Till we meet again around the pages of God's book, I bid you goodbye.